From the Song of Solomon. We're going to call it Solomon on Love, Sex, and Marriage. And we've reformatted the seating, we've reformatted the time, so I'm going to kind of fly through the material a little faster than I thought, because we're going to try to end right on time. You know that the book of the Song of Solomon, or Canticles, or Song of Songs, has a lot to say about love, sex, and marriage. The Bible has love, sex, and marriage mentioned in other places, but you would have to be careful about where you go in the Bible for some biblical advice about marriage. Here's some biblical ways you can find a wife, for example. If somebody was interested in the topic, they could study. You can go to sleep and let God make one for you, if your name is Adam. You can work 7 years and get tricked into marrying the wrong woman, and then work another 7 years. Then you would be who?
Jacob,
right. You can find a man with 7 daughters and impress him by watering his flock. You would be Moses. Go to a party, hide, grab a woman while she's dancing, and carry her off. A little harder, isn't it? That's the Benjamites at the end of the book of Judges. You can find a prostitute and marry her. Who did that in the Bible? Hosea. You can see a pretty girl, sleep with her, and kill her husband. David. So we're not getting a lot of help here, are we? Or we can not be so picky and make up for quality with quantity. There's Solomon. So if Solomon gets on this infamous list of models about how maybe not to find a wife, why would we turn to him in the book of the Song of Solomon to see what we could learn about love, sex, and marriage? Well, we'll talk about that. So this is the first of a six-part series, and we're going to review a little bit about what I talked about a couple weeks ago, and on your outline, we'll fly through this since this is a kind of review. Why does this Bible book even belong in the Bible? Is a good question, because the book doesn't contain the name of God. It doesn't talk about religion. It doesn't talk about rituals. It doesn't talk about the Jewish law. It really has no religious references in it. It seems to talk about love and sex. And some have wondered why the book would deserve a place in the Bible. Well, you know, to make the collection of Bible books, we call the canon of Scripture, there were certain qualifications. And in the Old Testament, the writer had to be Jewish. So we have an author who is named for us in verse 1 as Solomon. Of course, he was Jewish. He was also the author of other books in the Bible, like Ecclesiastes and much of the Proverbs and Psalm. And 1 Kings 4 tells us that he wrote 1,005 songs. So 1,004 didn't make the cut, but this one did. And that's why it is called the Song of Songs, which is a superlative way of saying Solomon's most excellent song, his best. And I have to tell you that as I study the words, you know, we're getting it in English. But as I study those who have studied the original language and incorporate the insights from that, I see how Solomon has beautifully crafted the language of this psalm in the original Hebrew. And we're not going to do any justice in the English, but just try to glean from the main concepts. But the language itself is just beautifully crafted from the Hebrew, a lot of wordplay and imagery. So we have Solomon here, and this is his major song. And it celebrates human love. And the idea here is that it belongs in the Scriptures because human love and the physical part of that also is such a big part of who we are and the way God has made us. And it was from the very beginning of creation. God created man, and he created woman, and he intended for them to be together. And many have noted that the Song of Solomon really appears to be a commentary on Genesis 2:24, which talks about a man shall leave his father and mother and then cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. And we have that shown and illustrated in the book of Song of Solomon. And so we take what we might call a common sense or literal approach to the song, whereas others in past history have taken a more allegorical approach. And allegory was a large part of interpretation of of the Jews sometimes, and also of later the early church. Allegory is when you take it in something and just look and find a spiritual meaning in it. For example, if we could look at a couple examples here, in chapter 1, verses 5 through 6, where she says, the Shulamite woman says, "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar." When she says, "I am dark but lovely," the early church fathers, some of them believe that she's talking about the ugliness of the church. It's not her physical person saying this, but it's imagery that refers to the ugliness of the church. And then she's lovely because she gets converted and her sins are washed away. So that's how you allegorize. Or look at verse 13. "A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breasts." There's actually a commentator of old who interpreted the two breasts as the Old Testament and the New Testament. Chapter 2 and verse 12. "The flowers appear on the earth. The time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land." And there was an ancient commentator who interpreted the voice of the turtle dove as the preaching of the apostles. Now, you might detect that there's a problem with allegorizing, and that's that you throw out all the rules and make it say whatever you want it to say. So that's not a very good way of interpreting the scriptures. And luckily, we hold to a common sense, literal approach. And when we do, we see that the book unapologetically and unashamedly talks about the physical and the romantic aspects of love and sex and marriage. And that's a good thing. We don't need to spiritualize it into something else to get a meaning out of it. We have plenty of meaning and plenty of application interpreting it in that literal way. And then also it points to God's love. Again, God is not mentioned in the book explicitly, although I'll show you a reference down the line in the last class that may point to God. But we see that He created love, romance, sex, marriage. He wove it into the fabric of His creation, so that's not just Christians who fall in love and get married and have sex and so forth. It's the whole world. When we observe creation around us, we deduct certain truths from it. We could call that creation theology. Creation teaches us about God, Romans chapter 1 says. And when we look at creation, we see that love and sex is a major, major part of the way God has made us and arranged things in the world. And marriage is an extremely important part of what God has designed for us, not just for Christians again, but for everyone in the world. So, and then when we see what He's done with marriage, He uses that as an imagery of His relationship to His people all through the scriptures. For example, His relationship with Israel. He talks about her as his wife, and in the New Testament He talks about the husband and wife as a mystery that points to Christ's love for the church. So there's that dimension of it. And the more we magnify human love, the more we magnify the creator of human love at the same time. And I think if we learn about human love, we can also learn about God's love for us. Just in the same way that when we study children and how to parent children well, we find out about how God parents us as His children. So all of that, I think, is intentional in His design for the world and the scripture. So the theological purpose of the song, I might put it this way, to extol the beauty of marital love and point us to God's love. Extol the beauty of marital love and point us to God's love. To remind us that God invented sex, He gifted us with it, and He made it enjoyable and a major and intense pleasure in our lives, something that fulfills us. And yet all of that should point us to God. The main characters in the psalm are, of course, Solomon. And Solomon's mentioned seven times. He was the king of Israel for 40 years. He was the richest man in the world at that time, probably ever. And the question is, did he write the song in his early age or in his old age? That has caused a problem. He appears as a shepherd at the beginning of the song, later as a king. So he must have been a king at some point in this. He mentions a harem in chapter 6 and verse 8. If you look there, you'll see He mentions a harem of 60 queens and 80 concubines. Well, we know he ended up with 700 wives and 300 concubines. So who is this smaller harem? Could this be a smaller harem earlier in his administration as king? Or possibly a harem that he inherited from his father when his father David died. It could be that. That doesn't preempt, though, the understanding that Solomon could understand what true love is. In fact, you know, he had 1,000 wives, but he may not have loved any one of them. Because a lot of marriages in those days with kings were political marriages and arrangements made so that like forming and signing a treaty with someone. You just marry the wife of the land, the king, the daughter of the king next to you, and make sure you're not going to go to war because you're family now. So hopefully that's the thinking behind that. If he was a young man, then this could refer to his father's harem. If he was an old man, he speaks from his wisdom. If he's somewhere in between, he's fed up with all the political marriages and has discovered true love. But there's no reason to doubt that Solomon is the author. Some people see two different characters as a shepherd and the king. And so there's three major characters, and Solomon is trying to win and woo the woman away from the shepherd. I don't take that interpretation of the song. Most conservative interpreters don't do that at all, but see the two players, Solomon and the woman. It could be at the beginning of the psalm when she talks about him as a shepherd that she didn't recognize he was a king, and that reminds us maybe of the King Arthur and Guinevere story, and Camelot, the movie of Camelot. He's in the forest. He looks like he's just out hunting or something, and she meets him and kind of is attracted to him. She doesn't know he's the king. Doesn't find that out till later. The second character, and really the story is told from her perspective, is the Shulamite woman, or Shunammite in some Bibles. We don't know why she's called that. It doesn't seem to be her name. She's never given a name, really. It mentions Lebanon as a possible place of her residence because she says, "Come away with me to Lebanon and meet my family." It could be that she's from a village called Shunem up in the Galilee area. Some have noticed that the name Shulamite is very similar in the Hebrew to Solomon. Solomon would be pronounced very similarly. And so in that way, it could just be that she's named as a counterpart to him, the feminine version of him, so his female companion. And really, the story is told from her perspective. Now, we have another interesting group called the Daughters of Jerusalem, and they appear a number of times saying little things here and there. And I might say that sometimes it's very difficult to interpret whether they are saying it or he's saying it or she's saying it. We have to look at the gender and the number of the verbs, whether they're singular or the person, people that are addressed, is it masculine, singular, feminine, singular, and things like that. And so Bibles will even differ how they divide the dialogue up. And so if I say something that's different, I'll try to catch some of those differences. But I might say, you know, the Daughters of Jerusalem say this, and your Bible has the woman, Shulamite, saying that. So that's the kind of thing interpreters have to wrestle with. But the Daughters of Jerusalem appear a number of times saying things. And what's very interesting about them is that something is said to them, I think, that becomes a major theme of the book. Now, who were these? These were probably the young maidens of the land, the young ladies of marriageable age. And so in that sense, the book seems to be passing on some advice to them. In passages like these three places, in 2, 7, 3, 5, and 8, 4, they are addressed directly by the woman. The Shulamite, she says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." And so she's trying to say, hey, just wait and be patient. Don't jump into love. And in a way, she's also saying, it is my time. I'm in love and I have a man in front of me. And it's my time. And he's desirable to you, but maybe God hasn't brought you a person yet. So don't stir up and awaken love until it pleases. Good words for our culture today as well. And we'll look at that as we go through the book. We'll deal more with that. But that makes me think that the book has a practical, pastoral purpose. Much like we see the book of Proverbs, Solomon is speaking to somebody that could be his son, The practical purpose of the Song of Solomon is to encourage and keep encourage us to keep sexual love pure and holy in the relationship of marriage. And so don't stir up love until the proper time. Well, when's the proper time? It's in marriage. I mean, you don't want to arouse your sexual desires and romantic appetites until we have the safety and the confines of marriage. And again, those are words much needed today when love and sex is blurred together as one, when marriage means little, when what God has intended as holy is profaned and perverted everywhere we look, see, listen, watch, whatever. In other words, they're saying this fire of love and romance and sex, keep it in the fireplace. That's the safest place for it. And that fireplace would be marriage. And so the structure of the book shows how the relationship moves from attraction to an actual wedding and wedding night and then matures. There's a period of love. There's some explicit talk about sex. And then there's some perspective on marriage. Or we could say courtship. And then there's consummation. And then there's a period of commitment. Or leaving, cleaving, and weaving. And that's basically how the book breaks down. But just the progress of that chart shows you that there is a time, and it's building towards that time, that the wedding is the time of the full expression of physical consummation of a romantic relationship. So this is how I'm going to structure the class right here, and I just put that out for you so you know where we're going. Today we're going to talk about falling in love. And from Solomon's perspective, this is not a class on how to fall in love or deal with love. We'll try to draw some applications from it, but we're going to see what Solomon has to say about that. I'm not the love guru. I don't want to be the love guru, but if we can just maybe draw some things out of the book together, but stick to the text and not turn this into a counseling session, that'd be best. I'm safer there. And then we'll talk about how we grow in love, and then we'll talk about consummating love, testing love, deepening love, and affirming love. Okay? So let's talk about chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. And I'm going to go at a pretty good clip and trust that if you have questions that you'll just interrupt me. That will be fine. But I am on a schedule, so I'm going to be moving pretty quickly. The passage that we're looking at today, I've outlined this way. After the introduction of verse 1, where Solomon is named as the author, and it is said that this is his best song, we find that there is a lover's attraction, and then insecurity, and then there's some longing expressed, and then there's some praise. So let's look at it that way. The lover's attraction. We come to verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Love, she is just intoxicated with the thought of him. At this point, she is not kissing him. She is thinking about that. You remember your first love experience and how you longed for a kiss. And you remember how you were just consumed with thoughts about that other person. And it was like you were intoxicated. You had lost your head. She says in verse 3, because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins love you. Now, ointment was something that you would use. It was very expensive, so it was a privilege largely of those with wealth. And so it might refer here in some way to the fact that he was wealthy, but ointments were used kind of to bathe with, but especially on festive occasions. So then the reference here also implies some joy in this, something special, but also joy. But what's interesting is in verse 3 is she talks about his name is ointment poured forth. When we see name in this context, it makes us think of the character of a person, the essence of a person. There's more to it than just what the name is spelled out in letters. It refers to who a person really is. And both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, it means that. The name of Jesus is not just Jesus, but all that he is. And what she is saying here, she is recognizing that his name is a sweet aroma. His reputation is a sweet aroma. His character is a sweet aroma. And the virgins love him. They recognize that. He's well known. And you kind of get the idea here that that they all kind of were attracted to this this guy, but she kind of won his heart. But they're good sports, I think, as you'll see as we move through the story. And she wants to be with him intimately. She says, draw me away. The word in the Hebrew was used for leading animals. It was also used for leading captives who were taken in battle. And I think what she's saying is, I want to be your prisoner of love. Just take me away. And now the next phrase, we will run after you, my Bible interprets it, is attributed to the daughters of Jerusalem. But here's a situation where some believe that she might have been saying this as well. We will run after you. It can also be translated, let us hurry. So she's saying, draw me away and let's hurry. The reason they attribute it to the daughters of Jerusalem is because it goes from the first person, draw me away, to the plural, let us hurry. But actually, that's something that is used in poetry in Hebrew language, going from first to third person quite frequently, and it happens all through the song. So it's a judgment call. Yes?
So the attributions that are in the New King James, at least, are not in the original?
They are not inspired. They are interpretations. Interpretations based on the flow of the dialogue, the tense of the verbs or person, number of the verbs, first, second, or third person, things like that. Yeah. But if she's saying it, then it's draw me away and let's hurry. And if the daughters of Jerusalem saying it, she's saying draw me away, and they're saying, hey, we'll run after you. In other words, they're supporting her in this attraction. She says, the king has brought me into his chambers. Now, this may be a little bit troublesome because you say we've been talking about a progression where she's been fascinated with him and thinking about him, and suddenly it sounds like she's coming into his bedroom. That's what the chamber refers to. But many interpreters think it's the best interpretation is may he bring me into his chambers. And it made a lot of sense when I studied that out and looked at the options that she would be saying, may he bring me. It's a wishful thinking kind of thing. So it's a wishful thinking that he would bring. She's looking forward to the sexual encounter. Now, let's be honest with one another. When we're attracted to somebody, we're thinking about kissing them, and our thoughts may go a little bit further when we realize that somebody is marriageable or could be a good mate. And so she's letting her thoughts go that far. And wishing for that. Now the daughters of Jerusalem respond, we will be glad and rejoice in you. And see, now here's a case where the you is feminine singular. So who's saying that? We will be glad and rejoice in you, the woman. So that's why it's attributed to the daughters of Jerusalem. You see how we determine these kind of things. And we will remember your love. And that's masculine singular. So they seem to be saying, we're going to rejoice with you, Shulamite, but we're also going to remember your love, Solomon, better than wine, more than wine. And that the only people left that really say that would be the daughters of Jerusalem, so it's attributed to them. And she says, rightly do they love you, masculine singular. So everybody is affirming that there is a genuine love going on here. Well, what do we learn from this? Well, romantic attraction is intoxicating. Intoxicating. She's spending her days daydreaming about this, and she compares it to being drunk on wine. Now, here's a good reference to wine. Wine in the Bible often indicated joy, festivity, refreshment, exhilaration, these kind of things. So it's not drunkenness. I shouldn't have used that word, but intoxicated. She's under the influence of him, like she would be under the influence of wine. You and I know that romantic love is a powerful, powerful force in the world today. Think of turn the radio on any station and listen to any kind of music you want to, and it's singing about love or sex. 99% of the songs. The world's fascinated by it. Look at movies, and look at the themes of the movies, and you'll see that the world is fascinated by the romance of love or sex. My wife and I went recently and saw Slumdog Millionaire, and it's a good movie. It won the best movie of the year. Pretty clean movie, as I remember, because Indians tend to make things very conservatively. But the whole story is basically this guy goes in on this show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, in India, and he ends up winning. But that's not really the main point of the show. The main point of the movie is that he went on the show because he knew that she watched it. He was trying to find her. And that's the only reason he went on the show, is so that he could find her. And it just shows that it's a love story. It's not about him being a millionaire. The whole thing is built around this idea of romantic attraction. So when, you know, I would see guys following my girls home after raising three daughters and following them home, you know, I recognize the attraction. That's natural, you know. But I would point them to my deer heads on the wall. And I'd say, yeah, you know, those are nice bucks. But, you know, when I shot them, it was during the rut when they were chasing the does and they lost their head. They forgot what they were doing. That's how they got introduced to me. So romantic love, Twitter pates us, right? Genesis 29:18 talks about, I think, Jacob falling in love with Rachel. He was just enamored by her. We'll look at some of these verses, but we don't need to look at that one. Love shouldn't be blind to character. She, the Shulamite woman, recognized his character, extolled his character. She was in love, but not blindly. And Proverbs 22 says that a good reputation is better than fine ointment. So love is not blind in the sense that it overlooks everything. But it takes into account everything, especially character. I was talking to a young lady not long ago and found out that her marriage dissolved. And she said she had a couple kids, I think, and sadly it dissolved. She said, well, I found out some things about him that I didn't know when I married him. And then I saw her recently. And I said, she had been dating another guy. And I said, are you still seeing this guy? And she said, well, I found out some things about him that I didn't know when I first started dating. So here's an instance where somebody, luckily, is becoming wise, maybe a little bit too late in this situation. But what do you know about the person that you're falling in love with? There are people who are experts in this world, probably. We call them experts at seducing the opposite sex, both men and women. Putting on a good exterior and learning the pickup lines. I'm not into that scene, so I don't know what it is. I noticed there's a show on television about something like how to pick up women or something, and the guy gives them pickup lines and observes them in bars or something. I didn't really watch it, but that's kind of the theme of the song. There's people that can do that, but it's got to be much deeper than that. When we're attracted to somebody. And then I think this shows us that the desire for physical intimacy is natural. It's God-given. So we don't, I don't fault anybody for being attracted to my daughters or my son's overprotective father that I am. I recognize it as something that's natural, but I'm sure going to screen them out a little bit and test them to see if they're really sincere. And there's certain checks that we build into this. But when God created man and a woman, and he created the whole world, he said, as you know, he said, this is good, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good. And there's only one time he said, it's not good. And that's when he saw that man was alone. And man needed a counterpart, a companion, to complete him and he her. And so he created woman for him. And then they became one. Now I know that some people who might choose to remain single or feel gifted to remain single might think, well, I can be fulfilled without a person. I think that can be true. I mean, obviously, people like the Apostle Paul got along just fine, evidently, celibate. You're maybe hoping that's not your gift or not your fate if you're single. The point is that God is adequate, but his normal design, obviously, is for a man and woman to be together and to procreate, and that's how he's going to populate the world. And that's how the world is going to multiply and fulfill and have dominion over the earth. That's how people are going to do that. That doesn't take into account the exceptions and the special gifts that God might bestow or the special calling that might bestow. I know a professor at Dallas Seminary who's single. In fact, he spoke here. He spoke here once, shortly after I stepped down. And he is chosen to remain celibate so that he can study and give himself to ministry. So Genesis 2:18 is where he said, it is not good that man should be alone. Now, verses 5 through 6, we see something going on here. I just call the lover's insecurity. She says, I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Now, poetically, what's interesting going on here is she says, I am dark and lovely, and then she gives two comparisons. And the comparisons would read like this, although the words are not there. Poetically, what she seems to be saying is, I am dark but lovely, dark like the tents of Kedar, but lovely like the curtains of Solomon. The word Kedar kind of means dark. It was a tribe of Bedouins in northern Arabia, and their tents were made out of the black wool of sheep. So their tents were very dark and black, but very rugged and weather-worn, and so not very impressive looking. But on the inside of any tent or palace would be curtains or tapestries, which could also be black but beautiful, such as they were for Solomon. It's not extremely clear that she is naming him as Solomon here, because the word could also refer to another tribe. But I think most interpreters put Solomon here. But what she's saying is, I am dark but lovely. She recognizes that her physical appearance is not perfect, but she's confident that her inner appearance is lovely. And so she says in verse 6, don't look upon me because I'm dark, because the sun has tanned me. Literally, the sun has looked at me. But don't look at me because the sun's been looking at me. She's been out in the sun. Why has she been out in the sun? My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my vineyard I have not kept. It seems that her father may not be alive, so her brothers have kind of taken over and maybe taken a little advantage of her and made her get out in the vineyards and do some work. But she's out in the sun all the time. So what she's saying is, don't stare at me or glare at me because the sun's been staring and glaring at me, because my brothers have been glaring in anger at me. And she's recognizing that she's bringing some baggage along here, family baggage, and not quite comfortable at 100% with her appearance. She recognizes she's very dark. Now, you ladies have spent so much, and you guys too, spend so much money at these tanning salons to get dark. In our culture, which is probably a good thing, in that culture, what was appreciated was the delicacy and the milky white skin. Someday I expect our culture to swing the other way around. So just hang in there, fair-skinned people, and you'll be on top. But I kind of empathize with this woman because I get dark so easily when I'm in the sun. I just get dark, and I'm out in the sun a lot because I'm coaching my son's track team, and then I've got track meets all day. I'm standing out in the sun, and then I go to a place like Iowa. I'll be there next month, and I'll be the only dark one there. I'll be really dark and tan by the time I get up there to do a Bible conference next month. And it, like last year, I didn't went to the same church. And it's snowing outside, and everybody's looking at me and saying, where have you been, you know? So it makes me a little bit self-conscious about my darkness, so I try to put a lot of lotion on and everything, because I just don't want to stand out and make people wonder what's going on. You know, it looks like I'm living in Hawaii or something. But she knows, though, that beauty lies within. I'm dark but lovely. And she copes with her physical insecurity. She realizes where it's from. She realizes due to her circumstances in life. And she's kind of accepted it, although she recognizes it. And I think there's some lessons here for us that we should cultivate inner beauty. Now, I'd like somebody to look up Proverbs 31:30 and 1 Peter 3, verses 3 through 4. Merle, you're flipping. Would you mind looking at Proverbs 31:30. And Mark, how about you? 1 Peter 3, verses 3 through 4. You see, if we cultivate inner beauty, we can still have confidence with the opposite sex or in a romantic relationship. And if we cultivate inner beauty, you have an attraction that many, many people will not have. I mean, anybody can make themselves look good. You spend enough money or do enough things to yourself, but not many people. But you can't fake what's on the inside. And there's not many people who are beautiful on the inside. And that's where you and I can have an edge on other people as we let God cultivate our inner beauty. So what does Proverbs 31 say?
Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised.
Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting. I mean, the charm referring to the outward beauty, that's deceiving. You know, we look at the models, and I'm very familiar with this genre. We look at the models, and we know that they're all made up, and they've got a lot of paint on their face and all kinds of things done to their hair, and that's not really how they look when they're at home when they wake up in the morning. And beauty is fleeting because we get old, and you don't see many 60-year-old models, you know, used by Victoria's Secret. Something's happened there. But the fear of the Lord, the fear of the Lord on the inside, she shall be praised. I like 1 Peter 3 because it's the verse that always reminded me of Karen, and I told her that when we were dating or courting. So it's a special verse for me.
Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God.
So don't just give attention to the outward adornment, but the spirit inside. I just love that verse. And how do you do that? Well, it's letting Christ live His life out through us. It's learning to walk in the Spirit so we can bear the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. These things are beautiful to people. And a good person looks beyond the outward facade and sees the beauty of a person inside. And that is the kind of person you want to be, and that's the kind of person you want to be with. So be comfortable with your appearance. You know what's interesting is in Isaiah 53:2, it says it's talking about in the messianic passage, it says there's nothing about him that attracted us to him, his physical appearance. There's nothing about Jesus that was attractive. Jesus didn't look like Brad Pitt, I take it. I don't know what he looked like, but he didn't look like Brad Pitt. He wasn't particularly attractive. He didn't attract attention. If Jesus was less than perfect looking, maybe we can be comfortable with how we look. You know, there's virtually nobody who wouldn't change something about the way they look. You know, I've always wanted to be about 2 inches taller. You know, there's probably other things I would tell you too. You would tell me things, but we are who we are, and we are who we are by the grace of God, and we have to learn to be comfortable with our appearance, whatever that is. I mean, that doesn't mean we just let it go, but it means that we accept what God, the body that God has given to us. In verse 7, we see her longing for him. Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock and where you make it rest at noon, for why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? Now, she longs to be in his presence. And she's wondering where he is. And at the same time, she doesn't want her actions misrepresented. And what do I mean by that? Well, it's because of this phrase where it says, why should I be as one who veils herself? Okay, and there's different interpretations for this verse. It could be that she's referring to one who is veiled, you know, like in a black veil of mourning. She's mourning because she can't find him. So why should I be mourning because I can't find you, she's saying. Another reference is to one who is a prostitute. And just jot down Genesis 38, I think verses 13 through 15, and where Tamar was tricking her father-in-law, and she dressed up, she veiled herself and covered herself like a prostitute and tricked him into having a relationship with her. And so prostitutes were known to veil themselves. Some have translated the verb wander, though, instead, because the Hebrew could be read that way. So why should I be like one who wanders around like I'm lost, is what she's saying. Many translations have left it open for interpretation. They just said, veil yourself, and you have to do the study to find out what's behind the term. I don't know if any Bible translations here call her, she's saying prostitute. Any translation saying that? They're just leaving it up for your best interpretation. They all three make sense, and they all three seem to indicate, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood or misinterpreted. If I'm look like a prostitute, I want my intentions to be sincere and above board. So here's a couple lessons for us from that. Lovers like to be together. Why? They feel comfortable with one another. She feels comfortable with him. She feels safe and accepted. And I think another good lesson is lovers should be careful of appearances. He says to her, she's worried about her appearance, of perhaps looking like a prostitute. And if that's the best interpretation, which I kind of gravitate towards that, then she said, I need to be careful about how I look, wandering around with other shepherds and looking like a prostitute, So tell me where you're at so I can get there and get to a safe place, is what she's saying. I think we need to be careful of appearances today with the opposite sex, where we go, what we do, and where we do it. I always try to teach my children to be in safe situations, to be with a group of people, and to not give the wrong appearance. In cultures like in Africa and India, physical contact with the opposite sex is not, even in marriage, is not shown publicly. You'll have two men walking down the street holding each other, and that's how they show affection, but not homosexuality. And women doing the same thing, but you don't usually see a man and a woman holding each other. I only saw it one time in India, and it stood out to me when I was at a festival. And even husband and wife don't show affection. But certainly young single people need to be careful about the appearances. I know one Christian fellow used to go to this church, and he invited a woman to live with him. And he said, I talked to him about it. I said, we're not sleeping together. I said, well, okay, let's assume that I believe you. Does your neighbor believe you? Does the rest of the church believe you? What's the appearance of things? Are we being careful about appearances? And then he praises her. He sees her beauty as a great distraction. Verse 8, if you do not know, O fairest among women, where I'm at, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tent. And he's just saying, look, I think this is what he's saying here. The little goats is in feminine form. He could be saying there, some people believe that he's saying, show off your feminine charm among the shepherds. In other words, you'll cause such a great stir, you won't be lost long. I'll find you pretty quickly. I'll know where you're at. So he's just saying, hey, just go walk among the shepherds and show your feminine charm and I'll find you. And then he says, I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Now, Solomon himself had 12,000 horses, the scriptures tell us, 1 Kings 10, and 4,000 chariots. Chariots were drawn by strong stallions. Okay, throw a filly in among 12,000 stallions, and what do you got? Chaos. So what he seems to be saying is, you cause a stir wherever you go, so I'll find you. You won't be lost long. You're going to be a beautiful bird in a room full of toads. You're going to be a filly among the stallions. And then he values her beauty in verses 10 through 11. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments and your neck with chains of gold. And we will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. Verse 11 could be said by the daughters of Jerusalem or by Solomon, just changing to the plural, saying we will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. But either way, we see that her beauty is valued, gold and silver being very precious metals. Interesting thing here is that the jewelry is not the focus. It's you are the focus, your cheeks, your neck. And so jewelry is not what is seen, but jewelry is what amplifies what is seen. A good advice for men and women, I was going to say women and maybe men, that the jewelry shouldn't distract from a person, but should amplify the person that they are. I've always tried to impress that idea on my children also, is that we don't do things to just draw attention to that. We want to draw attention to beauty and her character. And so choose the jewelry accordingly. And the Scripture has things to say about that, 1 Timothy 2 and 1 Peter 3. So men must learn to boost a woman's confidence, if we were to take a tip from Solomon here. How do we do that? Well, what Solomon does is lets her know that she is desirably beautiful. And he tells her that. And he does not compare her to other women. He doesn't say you're a mare among mares. He says you're a filly, comparing her to stallions. And you won't get very far comparing your wife to Victoria's Secret's model. That's not what's going to strengthen your relationship. Show her you value her beauty. However you may choose to do that, praise her publicly, as Proverbs 31 says, would be a way that you could do that. 15 years ago, my wife lost her engagement diamond, popped out of her ring, and she's lived without one for 15 years. And she doesn't put a big premium on jewelry, and neither do I, frankly, but, you know, 15 years, 30th anniversary, I thought she deserves a nice diamond ring. So I managed to get one, and I took her to Mexico, and the first engagement ring I gave her was in a fish's mouth, and don't laugh. I was watching the news this morning, and it was about a woman, and the guy put the ring in a Wendy's smoothie, and she ate it and swallowed it. She was supposed to find it, and he was going to propose, and she ate it and swallowed it. So I thought I'd do a little better. So in a very romantic setting in the Cancun area, I gave her another diamond ring. Again, it's not jewelry. She's not, but I, you know, she loves it, but she's not into jewelry, and I'm not into jewelry. But I wanted to show her that I loved her, and that to me she was my bride and beautiful, and loved her just as much as the day that I first proposed to her. And that's what that was all about. So jewelry has a place as a gift and a special gift for people. It was a way of saying I love you to my wife. And men, you need to think of ways to let your wife know she's beautiful, and that you value her beauty as well. Maybe what Solomon would do for us then, as we study this book together, is to help us to remember how it was like when we first fell in love. And maybe we can feel that again. For all the Bible study that we do and the technical language that we use, the Song of Solomon wants us not just to understand love cognitively, but wants us to feel it. And Solomon goes to great effort to help us to feel that love between two people. And hopefully that's the kind of feeling that we can learn to have towards one another, whether you're single or whether you've been married a long time. Well, let's thank the Lord for our time together. Father, we do thank you for this study, and pray that it might bear fruit in our lives by strengthening the relationships that we have with a certain person that you've brought into our lives. And may it all be done for the glory of God. In Jesus' name.